Are you ready for me? Okay, well, I Googled B-Fest, which is what it was being called in emails that I got, and this is what I got. Apparently there's a B-movie festival. So I just thought that would entertain you. So Chalin put me down to speak about abs / act pull ? So that's what I'm going to talk about. First I'll tell you something about abs, but actually before I do that, I wanted to say thanks for inviting me, and also I'm really appreciated all the talks. They've been incredibly frank on all fronts, and we are not far enough through our data analysis to be quite that frank, I would say, although I've given you some real numbers here from what we have so far, but I'm going to be a little rosier. Good. Okay, so Atacama B-Mode Search is this instrument sitting here inside the fence where ACT is. It was our plan was to build something that we could rapidly deploy to the site. So it's actually built inside, it was shipped inside the shipping container, and then it sits up on top of it to make the measurements with the idea that it could be very self-contained and just have a power plug, so we could do a lot of testing of it in the US. Its only aim is primordial B-modes. It has about a half degree beam. It's also a compact, very well shielded cryogenic telescope, but it's a refractor, reflector, not a refractor. It says designed for minimal foreground contamination. Well, aren't they all? But what I mean is it's aiming at the scenario that you can get away with only having detectors at one frequency, because as various people showed well earlier, in good regions of the sky, the foreground contamination is not as big as it is in bad regions of the sky. And I guess that was you, John, showing the nice plots that I think some work came out with the CMB white papers showing that, you know, someplace between 100 and 150 gigahertz is a good place to be. So ABS has 240 TES bolometer-based polarimeters. That means that's 480 TESs. Its special features are that it has these cryogenic all-reflective optics, which I don't think any other CMB instruments at all have, the reflective part. And then the other really big feature that it has that is a lot of where the rosy parts of my talk will dwell is this continuously rotating halfway plate. We got first light early in 2012, toward the end of February. About 80% of the channels are regularly functional and don't have to be cut. The NEQ is for the array is something like 30 microkelvin root seconds, and that's a non-rosy, honest number. It's on the sky, including polarization efficiencies and detectors that had to be cut and whatnot. Halfway plate is warm. I have pictures and whatnot in a minute. Okay. This is also similar to the plot that I think John showed of the neighborhood at the South Pole. This is where ABS sits from a Google map, and these are our neighbors. We're sitting up really near Polar Bear, very near ACT, and the instrument class will be coming in, and then their Quiet and CBI were somewhat nearby, and there are a bunch of other instruments up there. This is just a pretty picture of ABS observing from inside the ACT fence. This here is a attached baffle. It's now what we call the shiny baffle. We started out with a black baffle, and it was adding to our load significantly. So we took it off and scraped all the black out of it and put it back on shiny and improved our sensitivity by quite a lot.
Big thing,
dark round. Yeah, maybe it was easier to see in this previous picture. No. I have a picture later where you can see it better. Yeah, there's just a cone on top of that. This thing is honeycomb, and is what we call the outer ground screen, and it, as you can see, it also moves with the entire instrument. So the entire instrument is an L over AS mount. L over AS mount. Yes.
So you have been able to see this access load even with the existence of the load of the atmosphere. So this was a significant access load.
I mean, we took the baffle on and off multiple times and then did little sky dips. Yes, we could see it. It was a significant load. Okay. Yes. I'm about to show lots of slides and pictures that come from other people who've worked on ABS. And a large number of you have had the pleasure of hearing Akito Kusaka talk about ABS. So you'll recognize certain things, themes in what follows from talks that Akito has given. So this is just showing the ABS cryostat. It's also a pulse tube. Based instrument. It has it runs with two pulse tubes to give it tons of cooling power, and it has used closed cycle fridges so that the focal plane is cooled below 300 millikelvin with the helium-3 closed cycle system, and then there are two helium-4 systems to back the first system and provide heat sinking and the like. There are large magnetic shields that surround the entire, there are cylinders that surround everything. And the volume of the picture you're seeing is something like a meter cubed. Going back to the fact that AB ships in the container and then we get to the site and put it up on top, this is a picture of what it looked like in our high bay. We made this special frame inside the shipping container, and the mount, sat with the doer in it, sat down inside that frame, and then when we got to the site, we had the container set down, and then we opened up a big hole in the roof, and we jacked the instrument up, and that's how it runs. That was mostly to amuse you. Okay, so here are the ABS optics. I used to show this slide to talk about Cross-Dragone optics and how amazing they were, but now they're old hat. They're a compact way of being able to get a lot of focal plane area. There's the rotating half-wave plate sits up at the top outside the cryostat. The field of view is around 12 degrees, so that I what did you say for bicep 3? 28 degrees. That was diameter, right? Yeah, so it's big as well. And as you'll see, we go to a similar sized observing area. The mirrors are larger than the actual aperture stop, so they're something like 60 centimeters in size. And the stop is only 26 centimeters, so that's what sets our beam size. And of course, the advantage of everything being inside the cryostat it has been mentioned for the bicep and keck scenarios, which is that you can control the loading very well and also keep the loading on the detectors low, and you have a very stable environment inside there. And let's see, those are the optics in real life, the primary and secondary, and then this is the frame that holds all the detectors, and back here are the electronics that are needed to run the time domain multiplexing scheme that we have. Here's the actual half wave plate. It is not sitting on top of the cryostat here, but it looks very similar when it is. It's 33 centimeters in diameter. We rotate it at something like 2.5 hertz, and that puts the modulation of the polarized signal up at 10 hertz, and it runs with air bearing, so it wouldn't work in a balloon, but it does work in chilly, even though we only have roughly half the amount of atmosphere as we would have on the ground, and it's very, very, very stable. You basically can't tell that it's running, even when you put your hand on it, even when it's running at 2.5 hertz. So that part is very nice. The detectors that we use are Feedhorn coupled bolometers. They were made with the TRUCE collaboration, which was a collaboration among ACT and SPT detector developers with NIST, who did all the fabrication. So there's a transition edge sensor bolometer here that is attached to two of the probes. Which two is that one attached to? Apparently X. So it's attached to these two probes and therefore is sensitive to one linear mode of polarization, and then the other bolometer is attached to the other two probes and therefore measures the other one. The ABS detectors have inline filters that define the band. And that's about all of it. The concept for this type of OMT design coupled to bolometers was motivated by people at Goddard. So there they are. In this is the focal plane in real life. These are individually machined corrugated feed horns. The whole size of this is something like 30 centimeters to give you scale, sense of scale. Okay, so we've been observing for a while. We're focusing our observations on this primary field A. We spend some of the time also looking at this other field B, which is in a reasonable part of the atmosphere, and there are times when we could observe and neither of those patches is available to us, which is the advantage of not being at the pole is that cross-linking can happen just with your scan strategy instead of with deck rotations. But the disadvantage is patches don't stay up all the time. And at that time, we look at the galactic center. So the field A that is our primary field is around 2,300 square degrees, so similar to Bicep 3 and in a fairly similar place. And John inspired me to also show you this plot where there's more dust contrast, so you just doesn't look quite as rosy as this plot. And those are our contours for weights, but they were taken. They're like 6 months old. It was just to give you a rough idea. Okay, so just here's the rosy part of the talk. Now we have the great advantage that we have people working on the analysis for ABS who worked on quiet, Akito in particular, and also the ACT analysis with John Sievers helping us make maps. So you would think we would be practically done with the analysis already, but instead we spent a lot of time getting to know, and as it turns out, love, the half-wave plate. Digging into the data and understanding its features and whether they are evil or helpful. So I just thought I'd point out a couple of the novel aspects of stuff that you can do when you have a half-wave plate. We can measure our time constants very well. This is not a way that we measure the time constants in real time, because to do it, we vary the frequency at which the half-wave plate is rotating. But we do that, and then we measure how the phase changes of the output signals as a function of that frequency, and then assuming that you have one-pole filters, you get the time constants immediately. And it's great for us because it lets us calibrate to the method that we do use all the time, which is putting little steps in the bias and estimating the time constants from there. So graduate student Sarah Simon has given a talk on this at LTD in a day or two, but it was suggested by Akito, who is a font of good ideas. Let's see. Another aspect of the half-wave plate, which I'm sure that Shaul and Adrian, who've used them before, could have told me ahead of time, but probably wrote about it in MaxiPol, is that when you run the half-wave plate and then you take a power spectrum of your data, it has a lot more than 4F in it. Nominally you would expect any signal to be modulated at 4F. Instead it has components at 1F and 2F and 4F and the like. But what we've been able to determine is that that structure is very, very constant. We estimate it on all sorts of different time scales, and it's very constant, so we can remove it from the data. So here's an example of the structure versus the phase of the halfway plate. It's dominated by a 2 phi component, but there is a small constant component 4 phi, even when you're looking at a nominally unpolarized source. Tom Essinger Heilman, who's now a postdoc at Hopkins, he wrote he studied this and summarized in his thesis why you get the different components and what their primary sources are and whatnot. So it is up to me, terrifying when you first have the data and you look at it, but when you see how very stable it is, its good features emerge. And so one of the aspects is that this 2 phi component tracks the intensity. And so these are plots showing you the amplitudes of the 2 phi component versus PWV. So the atmosphere depends on PWV quite linearly. And so this is kind of like plotting as if we had control of some sort of unpolarized source and we could change its amplitude and look at the effects. The different colors are something like the Q and U components. They're the cosine and sine components that come out. So this is interesting because it gives us a handle for data cuts and understanding what's going on with the responsivity and a variety of other effects that we're just now exploring to do with noise mitigation. Of course, one reason, or the main reason one would rotate the halfway plate instead of stepping it, is to provide another source of modulation on the signal over and above the scanning frequency. And since we can rotate it 2.5 hertz, that means we're modulating at 10 hertz, which is pretty fast. And so when part of the reason you modulate is so that you can make your measurement in a part of your instrument's noise spectrum where the noise is white and not dominated by 1 over F. And in fact, demodulation of our data stream does move the 1 over F knee to really low values. And I didn't mean to cover this, but here's just a plot of the raw data. Well, it's not fully raw because we've removed that fixed pattern. That's what the DC subtracted means. And I didn't mean to cover it, but I'm not hiding anything here. These black peaks are largely are killed by the DC component. But there's this huge 1 over F, and maybe I should just move it. Anyway, the knee on this particular day was, I think, someplace around 2 hertz. And then once we've demodulated, and then we take the Fourier transform, the power spectrum of the demodulated time stream, it's beautiful, and you can see the scan frequency, but it looks really white. And then we take the demodulated time streams, and we look at all the 1 over F knees, and make a histogram of them there, and you see the median is something like 1.3 millihertz, and actually, right now we aren't very good at measuring low 1 over F knees because our file size is constant and not very long. So they may actually be better than this, and we're exploring that now. Yes?
So I'm looking at the demodulated data, and the 1 over F of the demodulated data is really a side value of your demodulation frequency at 10 hertz.
Yeah.
So what you call there 1 over F, if the side there of 10 hertz, you don't really mean that you have detectors that have inherent 1 over F going.
No, I don't. I mean our instrument component 1 over F or something like that.
Whatever
is that value?
The side there of 10 hertz. That's this 1 over F.
Yeah. I agree. But I mean, once you get to the computer level, this is what you'd call, doing the data analysis, this is what you'd call 1 over F. I agree. I'm not saying our TES bolometers are remarkable compared to others. I'm saying that being able to demodulate a signal that you put up at 10 hertz is an advantage. OK. These are just time stream plots before and after the demodulation. So if you note, the scale got a lot smaller when we went from this plot to this plot. And that's why I was asking Clem what you'd remove from the data, because this is removing nothing from the data. It looks really ugly compared to yours. And that's the, right.
Is that a nominal data, Suzanne?
Yeah, it was not picked in any special way.
Kelvin changes over 10 minutes or so?
Yeah. And this is probably something PWV of 1.5 or something like that, where our median is a little bit less than 1. So it's probably slightly worse, but it's not a lot worse. Okay, so this is my, I changed this line here. So it didn't claim that you had 70% in bicep 1. But this is a plot saying that an advantage of reducing your 1 over F knee is you might not have to, and we're not claiming this is true for apps, but you could feel rosy and hope that you might not have to remove as much stuff from the time stream, and therefore you might filter out fewer of those low L modes and get back a little bit more of the trough that experiments typically are not sensitive to due to having to remove structure. And the loss is significant. I think 10 to 20% is still significant, although not quite as exciting as the 70% that I used to have on this slide. And so that's exciting because a lot of the reason we wanted to run with the half wave plate was because it has different systematics than other, you know, instruments, because especially in our case where we're able to put it in front of all the other optics. But this is a concrete advantage that it may have. So I guess that's not very concrete. This is an advantage that we're hoping to explore for gaining back sensitivity due to 1 over F. You may wonder how painful it was for us to run the halfway, put it in front of all the other optics and leave it warm, since, for example, Ubex and Polar Bear have halfway plates that they keep cold. And it's something like a 6% degradation of sensitivity. That depends on exactly, you know, how much loss we have in the rest of the optical change, but it's my best guess right now. Just being able to get more and more of that region back.
We kill everything between the white lines.
I'm saying there's some point where we wouldn't be able to get it all back. You push in and get more and more of it back. The white lines are just meant to indicate that out of the box we might have to get rid of all of those effects. And then this is just saying that at the lowest L's there, no doubt we'll still have to remove means and stuff. So we're not going to gain back everything. And it's not meant, they're not meant to be in a special place.
With your scan speed and elevation, what's the corresponding?
Oh, I think I had that on the other slide. Yeah. Yeah, so it's coming in at L of 70 or something like that.
You don't scan at all?
No, we do scan. What do we scan at? But we're dominated by this. Our scan rate is visible, so it's visible here. We scan at that rate when we go around something like 15 degrees on the sky. So yeah, we scan slowly and not that far compared to our field of view. okay, and then one last point. Sir?
Don't scan larger than your field of view?
No. We reject Oh, the halfway plate lets you reject the spur. Well, the system, including the halfway plate, rejects the I to Q leakage fairly well. So this is a histogram of the I to Q leakage that we have. I guess this question came up for Akito someplace in Okinawa or something, as to whether this axis was already in percent. And it is in percent. So the worst detectors have something like 0.1% I to Q leakage, which is nice. As was mentioned before, there are ways to deal with this in analysis, but it's nice to start with a clean slate. And I forget whether we already made the point, but there's not just the CMB that you have to compare to, but any type of foreground contamination. Although I think your foreground template method probably gets rid of it just cares about what's on the sky, right? Sorry, you're not foreground, you're whatever you call it. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So the fact that this is true is not important for what your method is. I was really lazy, and Clive Dickinson had just given a talk in Okinawa, and I kept whatever he had just put up for that. Sorry. Oh, if you notice, I also didn't put, I just claimed leakage could dominate, and I didn't put a number up for leakage. This was meant to be a qualitative statement. That is correct, which actually gains us back more detectors, because sometimes one of a pair is dead. Yeah. Yes. 0.3%. The fact that that 4F wasn't, yeah. You probably couldn't tell, but in those plots versus PWV, it has some slope. Yeah. Okay. So, remember I'm talking about ab/ACTPOL question mark. Xiaolin, are you the one who's keeping me from talking too long? Perfect. Oh, yes. We're just not really done with it. Yeah, we've measured the beam of abs with Jupiter. And we measured it in our high bay, still in a near field limit. And it's, you know, all of those measurements agree with expectations. But Jupiter is not terribly bright in one of our beams. So we have Jupiter in RCW38, so we'll be measuring it unpolarized. Yeah. No, we never removed the halfway plate. We've done some things where we stopped the halfway plate, and we plan to remove it at the end. We are measuring the intensity all the time along with the halfway plate. You know, we don't have to demodulate the data, so we can do cruddy measurements, and we can also put up a sparse wire grid. So that then we measure with the halfway plate, we do measure one polarized component of Jupiter. And we actually haven't done that yet, because we were planning to do that, and it's snowing at the site, and it has been for an incredibly long time. Summary. Halfway plate seems really good and useful. We're analyzing the data now. We've kind of turn the corner to where we're no longer just like looking at the data and thinking about what our automated cut structure is going to be, to where we're starting to turn the crank, but it'll still be a little bit longer. Data collections continue. Some students have graduated, which is nice. Okay. So I just quickly thought I would shift gears to talk about the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, because as far as I know, this is just called B-Fest, and you know the origin of B wasn't fully specified in that. So the Atacama Telescope is a 6-meter off-axis Gregorian telescope. Why did I write 2-meter primary? I think I must have meant 2-meter secondary. Primary is actually 6 meters, and that's the name. It's up at the same site. Here's a picture of it from above. So that's the secondary mirror, and the primary is in here. So it's inside this really humongous ground screen.
Do you know, is your mean half a millimeter? Do you have statistics on the PWV?
What did I claim? The first season that we did stuff, our median PWV was less than half a millimeter. But with that instrument, that season, we were only taking data at night. Now that we're taking data with abs, and we have a two-day cycle period so that we take data during the day as well, and then we look at the PWV, the median is higher because of the daytime. It's higher. Right. Okay, yeah, a little bit more on the ACT ground screens because they're nice and helpful for whenever you have a CMB experiment. You really want to be guarding yourself against ground and environmental pickup. So we have these large co-moving ground screens, and then it sits inside this 13-meter tall outer ground screen. The mirror, as you can see here, is segmented, and we the overall RMS is pretty good. It was actually 21 microns RMS at the end of the last season we took for ACT, because we wanted it to be as good as possible, because we have a 280 gigahertz instrument on ACT. Okay. However, the original ACT instrument did not have sensitivity to the polarization. So ACT-POL is what we're calling the next generation receiver. Here's a picture of its cryostat. It's really big, but apparently I didn't put any scale bar on there for you to see. It's projected to have something like 16 times the mapping speed of MBAC, and we are in the process of installing it, and the installed detectors do not disagree with that estimate, so that's good. It'll have detectors at both 150 and 100 gigahertz, although more of them are at 150, and it's sensitive to the polarization. The science goals of ACT-POL, in brief, it will still have sensitivity to the intensity, to the temperature, so we'll be able to find even more clusters. Being not at the South Pole, we have a lot of overlap with surveys that already have data, other surveys, optical surveys, and the like. And also we just naturally will look at different parts of the sky than SPT, and so we are complementary in what we can do with clusters to SPT for that reason, and complementary to Planck because we can go deeper. We will, of course, get improved power spectra. Those are estimates of the noise levels on the EE and B power spectra for two different surveys that we have planned. One is wide and one is deep. And so we'll get improved measurements of all the power spectra, including the deflection field from lensing. We'll get maps of the CMB and the deflection field. So from the EE power spectrum, you can forecast that you can get some improvements in the parameters that impact the high Ls. But I would say you should take forecasts like this with a grain of salt at the moment, because they're relatively simple so far. But it's still true that that even though the EE power spectrum is a lot smaller, of course, than the temperature power spectrum, it's cleaner in terms of the fractional contribution from foregrounds. And at L equals 3,000, David Spergel likes to point out this fact, the CMB is actually expected to be something like 20% polarized. It'd be kind of amazing. That's a big number. let's see. We will be sensitive to the lensing. I gave this talk previously to graduate students, so I was explaining why it is that the peaks are more smeared out in the temperature power spectrum than the polarization. And I'm sure y'all all know that, but it's just because in temperature you're getting contributions from the simple harmonic motion position, there we go, position of the simple harmonic motion, and thus the density, but also a little bit from the Doppler shifts from the velocity. And of course, for simple harmonic motion, those two effects are out of phase, and so you have an overlap of two things that are out of phase. The peaks are more smeared. For the polarization peak, it's all to do V, so you get it's sharper. Right. This is comparing ACTPL errors in red to Planck errors from some blue book from a while ago. I should hurry. So lensing is a cool thing, as we see from Planck. You can make beautiful measurements of the deflection power spectrum. One of the things that we're proud of with ACT is that with ACT we use the fact that we had made the first CMB-only detection of the lensing effect to, we took advantage of the fact that the lensing depends on objects which are at a range of redshifts, and so when you detect the lensing in the CMB fluctuations, you're getting information from a redshift that's closer to us than the surface of last scattering, and with that extra information, you can break the usual degeneracy that you have, that you're fundamentally measuring one length at one distance. Now you can be kind of measuring two things at two different differences, and so you could, with using only data from the CMB, you can see that you have to have dark energy. It closed these curves, and then they were really closed, like really small, like squished, being really, really great curves with the Planck data. So there you go. It's also just to remind you, this is just the plot from the 2009 white paper showing you that when you're measuring the deflection field, you gain sensitivity to late-term type effects, like because of this fact that the lensing kernel probes intermediate Zs. And so this plot is showing, there's a curve right here that's showing the effect of W and neutrino mass. They cause different types of changes to the shape of the deflection curve. So that's part of the excitement there. I have this feeling that Adrian's going to give a talk where he goes into more detail on this. So we have forecasts that they'll be really good, measurements of the lensing from ACTPL. Just a small point. The primordial B modes, they peak at even larger angles than the temperature, right? That's because the speed of light is faster than the speed of sound. And so that means that ACT, which is really good at measuring small angular scales, in order to turn its attention to primordial B modes, would need to also be making measurements at very large angular scales. And we have great dynamic range. We make measurements all the way out here. This is a beautiful plot showing WMAP, Planck, ACT, and SPT. So we have very good dynamic range, and we designed the instrument to be very good at measuring large angular scales, thus those 13-meter high ground screens and the like. But it's not going to be that easy for such for an instrument, you know, where we so far spent all of our time looking at the highest angular resolution, and so our first target is going to be the lensing B modes. So I talked about ACTPL question mark, but I'm really only talking about its ability to do lensing B modes. And you wanted me to hurry, so I'll just show you this plot because it's cool. So for ACT. ACTPL, like ACT, uses silicon lenses. For ACT, we used Kapton machined as an AR coating because it's pretty well matched to silicon. But it has a reasonably high loss. It's, I forget how much it is, but something like a percent per surface, and we have three lenses. And so we decided to go to this other method of getting an anti-reflection coating on the silicon, which is just to change the effective index of refraction of the material itself by just getting rid of material in an appropriate pattern. So this is a two-layer simulated dielectric anti-reflection coating This is the smallest Actpole lens. This is a prototype. I think the prototype may be flat, but we have completed our first curved lens with the two-layer coating and measured that it has less than 0.1% reflection, which is amazingly awesome good news. So in this case, it's cut with a saw blade, not with a laser. And it's work that's being done by Jeff McMahon at the University of Michigan. And it's really great because now we won't have that loss that we had in the Kapton. What am I doing? What is the biggest lens that we can make? 45 centimeter bowl? It's 45 or 50, I forgot. We're no longer using float zone silicon, which was part of what limited the design in ACT to the sizes that the lenses we have, because we wanted to use that. But we did a bunch of studies, and we found that just the very high surface impedance silicon things freeze out, and so it is very transparent. I already showed you the detectors, but I didn't show you that adorable little logo about how there's a truce between ACT and SPT to do this. The detectors are, for ACT, we had 1 millimeter square pixels that in strips of 32 were practically continuous, and then they were separated by small gaps. It was a filled focal plane, not Feedhorn coupled, and so this is a difference for us. This is just showing one of the subarrays. You put together three hex subarrays and then sort of three half hexes. This is actually the Feedhorn array, but it mounts to a detector array. You then have to, we put all this truss structure behind it so that we can hold the circuit boards that do the time domain multiplexing nice and close. And that's the final system. And it was built largely by these three people, Emily, Laura, and Christine Pappas. Okay, receiver deployment. You were telling me to hurry before, so I'm practically done. So this is the ACT instrument, the cryostat, with only one optics tube and detector array installed. So the other two holes in the front of the cryostat are blanked off. This is sitting at the site in Chile in front of our new high bay building, just looking up at the sky so that we could understand both the detector performance and the dilution fridge performance, because we decided that we did a bunch of calculations and we found that it's worth it to go to 100 millikelvin instead of 300 millikelvin for two reasons. One is every other thing that you do to your instrument makes your sensitivity worse. I know you all know that who've used detectors. Everything you try to do tends to make the sensitivity worse. Like you go to these really big apertures, you have to put more stuff in there to block the infrared, although hopefully you can reflect it all the way. And the like. Getting it colder does improve your sensitivity. And the second thing is that the DR can run continuously, 24 hours at a time. So that opens up a lot of possibilities for us. And so it's the DR is working very well. The instrument looked up at the sky. Things looked really good. We put it into the receiver cabin a couple of weeks ago, and then it started snowing. We have been so snowed over there that our generator has run out of fuel at this point, and we are just waiting to get the road cleared. This is by far the worst snow situation that we've had since we went up there in early 2007. So hopefully it's anomalous. Oh, I know, but it's a stag. Stags get it. there are these two guys, Ben Schmidt and Marius Lunger. They spent, I don't know, 3 or 4 months in the field with Pato Gallardo and Masao Uehara. So thanks to them. And that's the end of the talk. Yeah, that was an aid filter. Yeah.
You mentioned NAVS and a lot of the main sheet. So I'm wondering whether you probably didn't run without the synthetic treatment, so I don't know if you know whether you see or you don't the negative effects of the squids even without the treatment. And maybe, you know, care, Clysite, maybe you guys could say, do we know that there's a problem?
Yeah, we know that for ACT, when we didn't really understand magnetic fields or shielding very well yet, we did like the worst possible thing for shielding our detector arrays, which was that the detector arrays sat here, and we went from a cylinder that was small, that was magnetic shielding cylinder, right there we switched to a large diameter shielding. And like my mental image now for thinking about what happens to magnetic field lines is they can't be rapidly squished. So if you try to make them go from one cylinder, they're all squished inside there because it's high mu material, to the other cylinder, they like spray out all over the place as you go from one cylinder. So we did have a fairly bad situation for shielding in ACT, but we were sensitive to the position.
Yes,
we had a minor scan synchronous signal. Luckily, all the detectors that aren't working in ACT, which is very few, but all of them that aren't working, you can just measure it in those dark detectors because they still are being can still be read out with the mic. So, what we did was sample that and. It's all in Rolando Dunner's paper. We did a nice thing. We were able to measure that very well and remove it, so it didn't end up causing us a huge problem. But it was a giant pain in the neck to do it. So, and it tends. You know, we're completely dominated by the squids, not the superconductors in the TES, being sensitive to things. So. I don't think that we're projecting for it to get a whole lot better. Do you know, Dick? I don't think I did. Or I might not have showed it because it didn't seem... Yeah, I didn't include an improvement for it. Less than a factor of two, I'm guessing. Yes, Phil.
ACT pole and SVT pole are to run similar tracks as they have been in the past. I assume they're similar here. Do you see much difference in sensitivity or?
Well, I think that for the instrument which is installed right now in SPT, it doesn't have very many detectors. So I someone's here from SPT, right? So I think that our 3 array system is more sensitive than SPT, but is going to be getting on the sky later. So that was a great answer, but I don't want to say something that's not quite true. Oh, you could say something that was true about SPT.